Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. It's a real pleasure to have you all here tonight for a very special evening, an exciting program with Dr. Joelle Wallach entitled Dvorak in New York. Let me begin with a couple of small matters. If any of you have a cell phone like I do in my pocket, please take it out and silence it so it doesn't compete with the performance and the music that you'll hear tonight. If you are new to the library, I know many of you are members, but if you are new or a guest, we publish two newsletters. We used to just do one, and now we do two, a big one called Notes and a small one called Events. And Events is what you'll need to look at for upcoming events in the library. And this is the March-April issue, which we have copies of outside. The Society Library does rely on the support of its donors, and the donors do make evenings like this possible. In this year, 2010, as you can imagine, it's even more important to have your support. So thank you for your support and considering the library. I am very honored to be here tonight for Dr. Wallach's event. I missed the last event that she did for us a few months back. She's an acclaimed composer who has been commissioned by the New York Philharmonic Ensembles and the New York Choral Society. She holds degrees from Sarah Lawrence College and Columbia University, as well as the first doctorate in composition given by the Manhattan School of Music. She's a frequent pre-concert lecturer for the New York Philharmonic, and we are really pleased to have her here again this evening. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Wallach.
I'm going to turn off my cell phone too, so don't be shy. Turn them off. I'm really glad to be here, and thank you all for coming also. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dvorak and the New World and the New World Symphony. In the late 19th century, New York began to have, aspirations to become a world capital. The United States already felt like it was a leader in inventions and commerce and tech. I'm going to tell you some of what had already happened in the 19th century in that field, which I found fascinating. In the 19th century, Americans invented usable electricity, the putting together steel in a way that made it more usable, steam engines, agricultural and industrial advances like the cotton gin, the grain elevator, miner's lamp, sewing machines, matches and matchbooks, typewriters and staplers, all American inventions of the 19th century, revolvers, safety pins, washing machines, propellers, telegraphs, Morse code, platform scales, rubber vulcanization, dental chairs, and dental anesthesia. It's a really funny thing. I mean, when were these invented? But in fact, they're all invented in the 19th century in America. The first man-made plastics were made here then. The bicycle frame, petroleum products, railway steam trips, and the motor-driven vacuum cleaner. Air brakes, traffic lights, stitchers for shoe welts, rubber heels, zippers, pneumatic pneumatic tires, the phonograph, fountain pens, metal detectors, believe it or not, something that's become very popular now, escalators, barbed wire, paper drinking straws, cash registers, and Coca-Cola. But to cultivated people in New York, it was the arts that would make New York a cosmopolitan center. And now I'm going to tell you about a very important woman to American music, whom people don't talk about. That's the way I do this, yes. Her name was Mrs. Jeanette Myers Thurber. She was born in 1850. Her father was an immigrant. He was an immigrant violinist from Denmark. And she was educated at the Paris Conservatory, came back to New York at the age of 19, and married a millionaire grocery wholesaler. And she was one of the most important music patrons ever in New York. She started not only the National Conservatory, which this is. Oh, I have a pointer. That's the National Conservatory. It was on 17th Street and Irving Place, where Washington Irving High School is now. This And these various pictures of her as a young woman and an older woman. And one of the interesting things looking at this is you can see how differently costumes happened, you know, how the world changed in the late 19th century. This is her in her study, and this is her obituary in 1946. She lived a really long time. She was the founder of the National Conservatory of Music, this building, which became Juilliard later. She also founded the American Opera Company. You can imagine what happened to that later. In 1884, she sponsored the first Wagner Festival here. And she sponsored the New York debut of the Boston Symphony. So she was like all over the place in music. And she wanted to create an American music. It was not only to, because most American musicians were either were trained in Europe, because there were only a few conservatories in the United States. Oberlin already existed, and New England Conservatory. So this was like the third conservatory, and most musicians went to Europe to be educated, and whether they went to Europe or not, the model for music was not only European, but specifically German. And she wanted there to be an American music. So what she did was she hired a Bohemian composer to create one. Now, why would she hire a man from Eastern Europe to do this? And that is because he was already famous for things like his Slavonic dances. He was a very famous composer already. Brahms, he was not a student of Brahms, but a protege of Brahms. Brahms had his own publisher publish his music and so on. And he believed in the music of the folk. Dvorak said, "It embodies my principles to preserve and to translate into music the spirit of a race as distinct in its national melodies and folk songs." So Mrs. Thurber and the board of the National Conservatory hired him ostensibly to direct the conservatory, but really to create an American music. She was central in his experience here. She negotiated all his contracts for him, including after there was the very year he got here, 1893, there was a financial panic, and she made sure his salary, which was not cut, his salary, and this is 1893, was $15,000 for 7 to 8 months of work a year. That's a lot of money in the 19th century. It's a huge amount of money. And she had a vision of American music which was very inclusive and very unusual for the time. She presented concerts of African-American musicians, students, both composers and singers, and Dvorak was totally in accord with this. In fact, one of his criteria for coming here, he wouldn't come here unless this school, this National Conservatory, would give complete scholarships to all Native American and African-American students. And they met his terms, and he came. First, he came with his wife and two of his children. Oh, that's there. This is him when he got here, roaming around on that part of the town. This is how he came, with four of his children, his wife, and a maid. And this is Stuyvesant Square, which looks a lot like it does then. This is the conservatory again. All of his activity in New York, or most of it, took place around that Stuyvesant Square area and Irving Place and so on. And this is his house. He lived in this house, which also had a basement, which you can't see. It was on 17th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue, just up 17th Street from the conservatory. He was very excited to come to New York. I should tell you that one of the reasons he was excited was that he had already started an opera, which he then abandoned, based on Longfellow's Hiawatha. Now, those of you who know about Hiawatha, Hiawatha is a complete figment of Longfellow's imagination. It has nothing to do with real Indians or how they lived or anything else. And similarly, Dvorak had already made up Indian music, which also had nothing to do with Indian music. And that piece never actually got finished. But he was very interested in it. When he came here, at first he was put up, before they got this house for him, he was put up in the Clarendon Hotel on Union Square. And the morning he got there, there was a big parade. And he said, He wrote home to his sister-in-law, who was also his first love and who the next year would come to New York also. He said, just imagine row after row of marchers, an incredible procession of people working both in the fields of industry and the crafts, and huge numbers of gymnasts among the members of the Czech so-called, and crowds of people from the arts, also many nationalities and colors, and all of this went on uninterruptedly from dawn until 2 a.m, thousands upon thousands of people, and an ever-changing sight. And you should hear all the kinds of music. Well, America seems to have demonstrated all it is and all it's capable of. I haven't got enough words to describe it all. But in fact, he took his mission very, very seriously and left a huge number of words describing it all and describing what he was doing and what he thought about it, as you'll see. He was a very principled man, and these conditions suited him very well. He loved this bustling cosmopolitan life. He loved this kind of array of immigration. And so let me play you, if I can figure out how, the very first thing, this very familiar thing, which was his idea of what Indian music would sound like. I'm going to try this. And as you can see, this is what we still think Indian music sounds like. I mean, that is funny. It's like all the movies and commercials as Indian music, but it's pure Dvorak. And you can hear it's also developed as a European composer would develop it. I mean, no Indian would do that. And even more developed in the next one. Will it do it by itself? Yes. Same melody. How many cowboy movies have you seen with this melody? And if you can sort of get beyond how much we've all heard it as commercials, it's an amazing thing. However, it is not real Indian music. Oh, stop, stop. We're not up to that yet. Stop. How do I make it stop? It's going on by itself. Make it stop. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. It's like this just the teeming American music. But he was interested in actually finding what he considered real American music. And he was aided by the same African-American students that he had given scholarships to. He said, Dvorak said, I'm convinced that the future music of this country must be founded on what are called Negro melodies. These can be the foundation of a serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States. These beautiful and varied themes are the product of the soil. They are the folk songs of America, and young composers must turn to them. And he also said, in the Negro melodies of America, I discover all that is needed for a great and noble school of music. They are pathetic, tender, passionate, melancholy, solemn, religious, bold, merry, gay, or what you will. It is music that suits itself to any mood or purpose. There is nothing in the whole range of composition that cannot be supplied with themes from this source. The American musician understands these tunes and they move sentiment in him. Now, this seems obvious to us now, but it was actually fairly controversial then. He also took his teaching very seriously. He said, my own duty as a teacher is not so much to interpret Beethoven, Wagner, or other masters of the past, but to give what encouragement I can to the young musicians of America. I hope that just as this nation has already surpassed so many others in its marvelous inventions, that's why I added the inventions, marvelous inventions and feats of engineering and commerce, it has already made an honorable place for itself in literature in one short century, so it must assert itself in the art of music. To bring about this result, we must trust to the very youthful enthusiasm and patriotism of the country. And his students loved that he believed in them this way. In fact, they loved him and they thought he was funny. They thought his name was strange and they thought his accent was strange. And they used to call him Old Borax. And he had one particular student who was extremely helpful to him. This is Harry Burley. And let me tell you about him. Harry Burley, these pictures are Harry Burley. And that's Harry Burley sitting next to his grandfather. He came from Erie, Pennsylvania, and he had been singing in his family's quartet and doing odd jobs as a laborer, an errand boy, and a messenger, and a stenographer while he was there. But he came to New York. He got into the conservatory and had a scholarship because of Dvorak, because of this blanket scholarship thing that Dvorak had started. He played bass in the conservatory orchestra, and he studied voice and composition. To help him earn a living, he was working in a pretzel factory, and he also worked for Mrs. Frances McDowell. She was Edward McDowell's mother, American composer. She also was the registrar of the conservatory. And what he would do with her was clean up. So he would clean the halls of the conservatory, and while he worked, he would sing spirituals. And Dvorak heard this, and he made him his assistant. Now, his main job as Dvorak's assistant was to teach Dvorak spirituals. Dvorak really didn't want him working in the pretzel factory. He didn't want him doing odd jobs. He felt that this was a very talented musician and he deserved dignity. So he also got him a job at St. George's Episcopal Church as a soloist in their choir. He was the first African-American to sing there, and there was a lot of opposition to it. There were other Episcopal churches that didn't even allow black people to worship there. But no black person had ever been hired there before, and there was a lot of dissent. Surprisingly enough, the person who went to his defense and got him hired was J.P. Morgan, who was a member. He cast the deciding vote, and Burley was hired. Burley was there for 52 years. And later, after Dvorak had gone home, from 1900 to 1925, he was also a soloist at Temple Emmanuel on 65th Street, the first black singer also there. He was the child and the grandchild of slaves. His father, when he was not a slave, and his mother, when she was not a slave, the father was a laborer and the mother was a maid. He got his knowledge of these spirituals from his grandfather, this man here. You see this man's eyes? They're closed. He was beaten when he was a slave and blinded. And because he was blind, he had no value. So he bought his freedom for $5. And he went north to Erie, Pennsylvania, bought the freedom of his wife and his infant daughter, who became Harry Burley's mother when she grew up. He wound up, by the time Burley was baby here, he was a lamplighter. And I love the idea of this blind lamplighter going through the streets singing these freedom songs. It's really a fantastic idea. But his grandchildren used to go with him to light the lamps when it got dark and to extinguish them in the morning. And since he couldn't see these children, he taught them all these songs so he could hear where they were. And so Harry Burley, who everyone called Harry into his old age, that was his name, he was very, very familiar with them, and they had, in addition to their natural sweetness, these melodies, they had the extra patina of this experience with his grandfather, whom he loved. He loved other music, too. His mother was a maid for these wealthy people in Erie called the Russells. And the Russells were patrons of the arts in Erie, Pennsylvania. Raphael Josephi, who was a Hungarian pianist and composer who was then living in New York, came to Erie to play, and Harry Burley would stand outside in the snow listening. And he made a career on these spirituals. Many of his arrangements are still the arrangements that famous people sing, and did then too, and did in the next generations. Let me play you now. Let's see if I can make this go to 4. Well, let's go to the one that was a mistake before. Let's go to 3. This is probably how his grandfather sang the song to him. 3? Do I have it on 3? Oh. Let's go to the beginning of it, though. That's not how he could have sung it. No one would have liked it if he sang. No. Number three. That's one. That's two. Okay. Yes. No. The next one. I could do it probably from there. Yes. That's probably how his grandfather sounded. And this is a Burley, an accompanied version by Burley, let's hope. Nope, wrong one. Oh, come on, guys. Four. I just want the next one. Yes, good. I got it. Thank you so much. This is a Harry Burley arrangement, and probably the one that everybody knows. He turned them into art music so that other European singers like John McCormick sang Harry Burley arrangements in concert. And this one, also a Harry Burley arrangement, very close to the song that winds up the song that winds up in the symphony. I think we've got it? Yes. Thank you. And I'm playing that one specifically because I can't stop this machine. There's no way to stop it. It just goes by itself. Thank you. There's no pause. There's no stop. It's hopeless. Because it's very like what Dvorak wound up putting into the New World Symphony. Burley said, and they would have, because of the nature of these spirituals, they would have long conversations about the symbolism of the River Jordan, about death, freedom, and the longing for home and the nature of home. Because, in fact, Dvorak was, even though he loved living in New York and he was fascinated by it and very busy, he was very homesick. Burley said, "I sang our Negro songs for him very often, and before he wrote his own themes, he filled himself with the music of the old spirituals." And then Burley describes the scene in his house. "He was in his shirt sleeves with all his children around him. He had bird cages." Oh, I forgot to mention, he loved birds. Inside the house, outside the house. He had bird cages all over the house with thrushes in them. He kept all the cage doors open, so the thrushes flew around freely and joined in the singing, and I'd accompany myself at the piano. This is still Burley speaking. "I have never been publicly credited with exerting any influence upon Dr. Dvorak, although it is tacitly believed that there isn't much doubt about it. The great master literally saturated himself with Negro song before he wrote The New World." And this one, this next one, if I can do it. Six? Is very, very close to the one I'm going to play you next, which is The New World. Now I'm going to go right to seven. Go right to seven. See what I mean? It's really close. It's not the same. It's amazingly close. It's hard to stop it, isn't it? It's just so beautiful. Now would be great. Thank you. It's not a folk song, and it's not a spiritual. But you can see what Burley means. He really absorbed this stuff so that it sounds like that. And in fact, another one of his students, whose name was William Arms Fisher, another African-American student, 30 years later put words to it and called it Going Home and turned it into an ersatz folk song. Ersatz spiritual. And this is, and in fact, on the title page of this Going Home, which was this melody that Dvorak wrote with these words by his student wrote, "The Largo, this movement, with its haunting English horn solo, is the outpouring of Dvorak's own home longing, with something of the loneliness of far-off prairie horizons, the faint memory of the red man's bygone days, and a sense of the tragedy of the black man as it sings in his spirituals. Deeper still, it is a moving expression of that nostalgia of the soul all human beings feel. That the lyric opening theme of the Largo should spontaneously suggest the words going home, is natural enough. And that the lines that follow the melody should take the form of a Negro spiritual accords with the genesis of the symphony." Dvorak said about this, "Forget that nonsense that I use Negro melodies, because it's a lie. I only tried to compose in the spirit of those melodies. That's it," he said. When he was in a better mood, he said, "I have not actually used any of those melodies. I have simply written original tunes embodying the peculiarities of them and using the themes as subjects, have developed them with all the resources of modern rhythms, counterpoint, and orchestral color." And many scholars, including Leonard Bernstein, think what this student said is true, which is that the melodies have also a very essentially Slavic quality to them, not simply a spiritual one. But, you know, all of our experiences are always filtered through the lenses of his own experiences. And he really did long for home. And he spent his off months when he wasn't there in New York, when he wasn't teaching at the conservatory. He went to a place called Spillville, Iowa, where there was a huge Czech community. And he missed the birds of Prague. And he missed the railroads. He spent a lot of time in the railroad yards in New York and in the harbor because he loved boats. And he made friends with the musical community that came from Eastern Europe, including this man, Anton Seidl. You recognize this building? This building still stands. It's Carnegie Hall. But now it has a tower on top. It's Carnegie Hall. And this man, Anton Seidl, was a Hungarian Wagner proponent who was the composer of the orchestra that became the New York Philharmonic. This was the Philharmonic Society of New York, which was founded 50 years before this, before Dvorak came, by local musicians. By this time, it had a regular season of 4 concerts a year, which is sort of amazing because now it has a regular season of 4 concerts a week. But it was a going concern, and in fact, there was a second major symphony orchestra in New York at the time that had been founded in 1878 by Leopold Damrosch, and they wound up merging in the 20th century in 1928 and becoming the New York Philharmonic. In any case, this orchestra was pretty close to being what the only thing the New York Philharmonic might be at the time. They used to, Dvorak and Seidl used to have lunch together in this cafeteria on Irving Place. And Dvorak was this very enthusiastic, very humorous man. Now, it's very important that Dvorak was very humorous and that Seidel had no sense of humor. Now, how do we know this? We know this because they stayed friends and they continued to correspond when Dvorak went home to Prague. And Dvorak would send Seidel a letter and it would have a joke in it, and Seidel would answer it seriously, and the next letter, Dvorak would have another joke and an explanation of that joke. And, you know, it's very frustrating if you're a funny person doing that. But he had a lot of patience with people he liked, and he was very patient with him, but Seidel really didn't get his jokes. This is very important to the story of the symphony. So he had lunch with Seidel, and Seidel suggested that, and he told Seidel about this new symphony. And Seidel suggested, this was the part that amazes me, that they program it with the orchestra the next month. Right? Anybody who has had anything to do with this orchestra or any other major orchestra knows it's like 10 years in the future. Maybe. More like 15 in some, about something. So he thought it would be great to program it the next month at the orchestra. So Dvorak went home. He was virtually finished with the piece, and he was exuberant for a lot of reasons at that day. And he finished the piece, and he wrote on it, Fine, praise be to God, May 24th, 1893, at 9 in the morning. And then he went around the room. He was really happy, and he wrote again. He went back to the score, and he wrote, Family arrives at Southampton, telegram 133. And that meant his sister-in-law and his other four children were coming. And then he went back. It was like he really didn't have enough words to describe it. He went back and he wrapped it up for Seidel. And just before he closed it up, he wrote a joke on it. He wrote, from the New World. It was a joke. He didn't mean it to be the name of the symphony. It was a joke. Because they had just been talking about the New World and joking. And he wrote it on the symphony. And Seidel, it became the title of the symphony. But it did reflect his impressions of the New World in many, many ways. Now, one of the interesting things is how many... One of the other differences as a composer, I mean, this is so appealing, and it doesn't exist any longer. You know, they were friends, and you could still go over a piece and change it while it was in a rehearsal with a major symphony. And this was the New York Philharmonic, which even then, by its other name, had a very strong sense of how historically important this piece was and they were. And so... I found these in the archives of the New York Philharmonic. These are details of things they crossed out. Here's the first violin part. They crossed out these two measures. They took them out. They changed the bowing. They deleted two measures. Here's more. The horn part. He deleted a bunch of measures in the horn part and changed it from having a first ending. He didn't want a repeat anymore. Dvorak and Seidel together. Here's one that only Seidel did, and this is an interesting one. Seidel made the largo that you just heard slower. It was a faster tempo when Dvorak wrote it, a little faster than that English horn part you heard. I find this so interesting. And so wonderful, you know, to be able to do what people like Bach and Mozart were able to do, which was try things and refine them on the actual musicians. Because just like if I read this paper to myself at home silently, it goes faster and it feels different than when I tell it to you. Music is like that too. There's something about when a live person plays it that's different. So they have the luxury of doing this. So, let me play that part one more time, number 7. And here, imagine how wonderful it is, this little amount slower. Number 7? Yes, please. It wouldn't be quite as wonderful a little faster. Although, let me stop it somehow. I'm afraid to do anything here. And now you might as well not stop, because now we're going to go through a whole bunch of these at once. What's interesting about it is that, of course, it has metronome marks on it and so on. You would think that this is quantifiable, but in fact, this symphony is played at very different tempi. And this also you can find out at the New York Philharmonic Archives. When Carl Anserl did it in 1969, it took 37 minutes. When David Zinman did it, it took 47 minutes. 10 minutes is a lot of difference in time for the same piece of music that's, you know, a half hour to 45 minutes long. So people still do it at different paces, but I think it's very interesting that Seidel really wanted it not to say Larghetto, so it wouldn't have any suggestion of a lightheartedness about it. Now, don't forget he wasn't only interested in the Negro people that he was describing and the Indian people who were not even in New York much, but all of these immigrants. Remember all those gymnasts and all those people he was writing home about? So there's all kinds of other stuff in there. Now, these go quick. 8. I'm so happy you're here. This was a time of huge amount of Jewish immigration. Next one. This is an Irish thing, almost like a jig. And here's this big prairie sound, the next one. Thank you. And one of the interesting things about this is that there's a complete silence. There's a little silence in here somewhere, I think. I may have just talked over it, which is like a big sob. Now I'm going to play you a different piece that's not by him. The next one, number 11. What is this? What is that? Yes, it's the beginning of the fourth movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Now, will you play us the next thing? This is 12. What is that? That's the beginning of the third movement of the New World Symphony. Do you want to hear those two again? Okay, go back to number 11, please. There's the Beethoven. And number 12. It's not an accident. But what is that part of the Beethoven about, that fourth movement? What is the Schiller that they sing about? It's about brotherhood, and right? It's Freude. And this is what he was writing about in the New World Symphony when he was talking about the parades of immigrants and so on. I think it's a wonderful little thing he buried in there. Very interesting man. And again, part of his funny kind of humor, you know? Please don't go away. Then there's the cowboy quality. Now, cowboy qualities, you have to remember also what was going on in the politics of New York then. Like, who was the great person in politics here? He was actually the police commissioner, then he became the governor. Teddy Roosevelt. He was born in Manhattan, and he went to Harvard, and he bought a ranch. I mean, he was like a phony cowboy. So, this is phony cowboy music, number 13. It's true. He has not only all of America, thank you, but he's got all of America's misconceptions, too, which is kind of what's wonderful about it. Another kind of spiritual, number 14. This is like, it's really like a big, and the next one. This is for the big wave of Italian immigrants. Number 15. It's a tarantella. Can we skip to number 17 now? Three Blind Mice is a Chinese folk song. I mean, Ives was going to do this years later in the America variations, but Dvorak had already done it. Let's see. Now, he wrote the first three movements in a very short time. He sketched the whole first three movements in about 3 weeks, but it took months and months to write the fourth movement because the architecture of it is such that it builds a huge amount of momentum from these things. Maybe we could go to 19. I'm just trying to see what time it is and how we're doing. Good. 19? Could we have 19? Sorry. And you can see how he builds this gradually and in a huge way. This is a massive, heroic ending. Now, we could stop. Once it was premiered, you would think that everybody would have been very impressed and grateful. But in fact, it wasn't quite like that. Because of, remember we mentioned the invention of the telegraph? Well, because of the invention of the telegraph, there was news of this on both sides of the Hudson, and plus Dvorak talking about it. Now, in America, who are these people? These are actually American composers. This is Edward McDowell and his wife. And this is a man named Arthur Byrd and Arthur Falwell, Scott Joplin up here. Let me tell you what they said. Edward McDowell and John Knowles Payne, who was over here, who was at Harvard, they really hated this. They hated it. They said, we have here in America been offered a pattern for an American national music costume by the Bohemian Dvorak. Though what Negro moralities have to do with Americanism and art still remains a mystery. But then there were American composers like Farwell, that's him. Oh my God, now what do I do? What have I done? I've turned it off, I stopped it. How do I start it again? I'm so sorry. This isn't what I'm best at. Oh, hey, great. Farwell over here, he said, he thought it was such a good idea that he decided to make a project out of Indian music, and he invented a press for Indian music. Now, how he found enough of this? He said he wanted to launch a progressive movement in American music, including a definite acceptance of Dvorak's challenge to go after our own folk music. He called it the Wawan Press. Black musicians were very enthusiastic. In a black newspaper called The Free Man, it said Dvorak's statements were a triumph for the sons and daughters of slavery and a victory for Negro race achievements. They referred to him as Father Dvorak, our greatest friend from across the sea. And William Warfield later in the next century said that the bond with Dvorak lives on into black music circles. However, across the ocean, in Europe, there were really different opinions. Joseph Joachim, who is this violinist, who was very instrumental in helping Brahms write his great violin music and so on, said, it may be a very good idea to try and merge the American Negro melodies into an ideal form, and that these melodies would then give a tint to the national American music. Arthur Rubenstein, he's over here, said, if there's a great literature of these Negro melodies, Dr. Dvorak's idea is possible. So they're going to allow Negroes free musical education. That's very interesting. And they may develop a new melody. It's refreshing, of course. In 25 or 50 years, we may see whether the Negroes can develop their musical talent and found a new musical style. Arthur Bird, who is the American composer on the over here, he said, I wonder whether the Negro melody's simple, sad musical would lose from being instrumentated. And then to go back to the Europeans, Bruckner, the guy up here. By the way, Brahms is here because Brahms loved this stuff. Brahms really believed in it. He got Simrock to publish the New World Symphony. He himself, one of the very last things Brahms did in his life before he died, was edit the New World Symphony for publication. So, I mean, he was a very great champion of this music. This little picture down here is here. These are all black people. These are all black men. These are black American composers. And the picture is taken of them in Paris because that's where they had to go to be trained until Dvorak did this. Black musicians. There were a small number after Dvorak that went to New England Conservatory, Oberlin, and this National Conservatory, but they were mostly trained in Europe. But they were trained in numbers in Europe. They were not an unknown quantity. So I need to say that before we hear what Bruckner and Hans Richter, this guy, said. Bruckner said, German musical this is an article in the New York Herald. I have to tell you that that's where it comes from. Anton Bruckner and Hans Richter in Vienna. The article is called A Cold Water Douche. Bruckner, this man, says, German musical literature contained no written text emanating from the Negro race. However sweet the Negro melodies may be, they could never form the groundwork of a future music of America. Bruckner had apparently never understood the Kreutzer Sonata of Beethoven. The Kreutzer Sonata was not originally written for Kreutzer. It was written for a man named George Palgrin Bridgewater, who was a black violinist, and the original name of the Kreutzer Sonata was the Mulatika for this George Bridge Tower. However, be that as it may, the final comments, which were attributed to Hans Richter. Hans Richter was conducting the Ring at Bayreuth, and he was the leader of Vienna's Imperial Opera Orchestra, which very soon would have a Jew leading it when Mahler took it over. He said, Richter is very enthusiastic concerning America and believes greatly in its future music, but he could not realize that this could emanate from the Negro race. Nor would he admit that persons playing by ear, this is why I wanted you to have these black composers who were so highly trained, that playing by ear could be taught music properly or had ever given evidence of talent in this respect. He spoke of the gypsy race of Hungary, every man, woman, and child of which plays by ear, but said that it was an exceptional thing for a gypsy to play for written music. So we see all these amazingly racist assumptions, both in Europe and here, and it makes you realize what incredible insight Dvorak had, as well as generosity of spirit. Meanwhile, it's done very well, despite all the naysaying. It did very, very well. I think we have to stop pretty soon. It was his last symphony, but it wasn't his last piece. It wasn't even his last major piece here, because in the summers he went to this place in Spillville. And there, I want to show you this. This is Spillville, Iowa, where he spent the summers. He lived here on the second floor of this clock factory. It was handmade clocks and hand-carved wooden clocks. And he made a Dvorak clock in the shape. Isn't that lovely? There's a picture of Dvorak, and there's the clock in the violin shape. It's very sweet. These are people there. And this is a harmonium. He didn't have a piano there. He composed on a harmonium. And when he was there, he composed some very great American chamber music, the American quartet, the American quintet, string pieces. And he was influenced even by the birds. Let me play you. Oh, this is the second disc. And we're going to skip to number 3, which has this bird in it. It has this. He loved these birds. He put them in the music. This is a bird, this is a Midwestern bird. It's a scarlet tanager. And if you want to hear them and how similar they are, the Audubon site has their calls. Ready? This is number 3. The dee-da-lum, dee-da-lum is very like their call. He became interested also in Indian drums. He had his first taste of actual Indian music there. Now we'll skip that example and move because I see that we're running out of time. In any case, he was here for 3 years. And he went back to Prague. He became the director of the Prague Conservatory. He wrote 3 more operas. Before he left New York, he wrote his cello concerto. And the reason he wrote his cello concerto was he decided that was very American, too. He heard Victor Herbert's cello concerto. Have we ever heard Victor Herbert's cello concerto? None of us have ever heard this piece. Victor Herbert had been the director of the conservatory before he got there. And so he was a well-regarded American composer, and Dvorak thought it was a very American sound. Why he thought this when there are plenty of European ones, I don't know. But he wrote a cello concerto here in New York on 17th Street. But when he got back to Prague, he was the director of the conservatory. He wrote 3 more operas, many other small works. And he died in 1904, a national hero. You can see how he gets old fast. And he has a beautiful grave there, beautiful commemorative things. But, I mean, he was not a very old man. He was in his early 60s. Now, he was loved here also. He left a legacy of not only music, but this tradition of American music, as you know, because we hear this in all these commercials still and so on in movies, that Mayor LaGuardia had a historical plaque, that one, put on his house in 1941. The building was finally granted landmark status in 1991, and 3 months later, it was raised. It was raised by Beth Israel Hospital, which somehow got the city council to agree that it wasn't a landmark, and they raised it. Now, there is actually this statue and this plaque now in Stuyvesant Park. Now, why? By the way, I love this cartoon of him with the bird on his head. Isn't it very, very charming? Very typical of him. And he would have loved that with his humor. Now, he would also have loved what happened with the statue. In 1962, a bust of him, this bust of him, was given to the New York Philharmonic when it opened its new building at Lincoln Center. But they didn't like it. They felt it wasn't modern enough for Avery Fisher Hall. Also, it was functional more than Avery Fisher Hall, probably. And they didn't want something that actually worked there. Can you imagine moving from Carnegie Hall to Avery Fisher Hall? It's just so awful. Anyway, they put it on the roof. They thought they were going to have a roof garden on the roof. But it's too windy on the roof. And so there was no roof garden ever on the roof. And the only people who ever knew it was there were certain people who couldn't stop smoking. And so they would go up there and smoke and enjoy this bust. But then they renovated, in one of the many renovations, one of the many hopeless renovations of the hall, they gave it away to the Bohemian Society of New York, and they installed it in Stuyvesant Park, where it now is. But still, And he would have liked that also. He would have liked the whole mess with the statue on the roof that nobody ever sees and so on, and the landmarks thing, and then they tear it down as soon as it's a landmark. He would have thought the whole thing was funny. But now there actually is this bust of him and this plaque in Stuyvesant Park and forever the New World Symphony. So that's pretty much what I wanted to say. Do you want to make comments and questions? Thank you. Thank you. One and then two. Ah, wonderful.
So our group is the one that fought battle trying to save Boshock House, which was then the landmark that was reversed, sadly. It was one of the most hard-fought battles in New York landmark history.
Well, I can even tell you the years, like from the time of 1941 when Mayor LaGuardia wanted to do it, it took until 1991 until it got landmark status. And in 1991, it was also raised.
All part of the battle to save it.
Mm-hmm. It was fragile.
And I managed to put it in the laundry room. So I was tracking down the story that I heard about a second Boshock statue, and we managed to rescue it, restore it, and it's now in the Boshock room, which we're working on developing as a study center. So that's a long story.
Do you know where that Dvorak clock is?
No. I imagine it's in Spillville at the Clock Museum. Because
yes, that's true. And they also have a Dvorak room, too, yeah.
So, anyway, we have a website, dvorakny.org, and I think you might have seen that.
Oh, yes, I got some of these beautiful pictures from there. Yeah. Thank you.
First of all, I want to thank you for a very enjoyable and entertaining meeting.
Thank you.
But I'm curious about the Hiawatha opera. How much did he finish, and did any of it...
No, and you know... Maybe he got this from Brahms. Brahms, you know how like every Brahms piece that you hear is a masterwork? Everything. You know why? Because Brahms destroyed 3/4 of his work. And I think Dvorak may have taken a lesson from him and done this as well. I think it's a really good thing for someone to do, especially now in the age of digital preservation, where like people can dig up like things you never meant. So it may be that he destroyed it himself. I've never heard anybody wanting to put it together, and I don't know what stage it was at when he gave up on it. But I think one of the reasons he gave up on it was he got here and he realized that those melodies weren't anything like what Indian melodies were, and perhaps he realized that Hiawatha wasn't anything like what Indians were like either. What did I use there? I don't remember what I used there. I'll use the Bernstein. Bernstein. It's my orchestra. I don't like their hall, but I love everything else about them. Yes, sir.
How well did Dvorak speak English, or did he communicate in German?
My guess is that he spoke a lot of German. But I think these quotes are not translated, so he probably spoke quite good English. You know, Europeans, especially from languages that are not, like Czech is not a language, lots and lots of things are done in outside of Bohemia. And so he probably was multilingual in French, German, and English, and maybe Italian, probably Italian.
Like 7 or 8 trips, and the British, loved his choral work.
Of course.
There, and he did study English. I don't think he ever got rid of his accent, and I don't think he was capable of, making a lot of these remarks that were in the newspaper in his own. I think they were filtered through other people.
Oh, really?
In this debate about real men.
Oh.
For the Herald, but also much entertained by Jeanette Thurber.
Oh, I see. But he was also speaking to his students. I mean, there's no question that Harry Burley and he were speaking about, you know, abstract and important things in English. So he did speak English. Yes. Oh, that's wonderful.
The clock is really there.
The clock is really there? That clock? You saw that clock? Wow, that's great. Anyone else want to say or ask anything? Yes.
Where is this book?
That is in Cleveland. And I don't know why. I don't know why it's in Cleveland. There's a lot of music in Cleveland. And it's like the first orchestra in the United States ever to have a woman in it. I mean, it too is a forward-looking orchestra. Anything else? Anybody else want to ask or say anything? Well, thank you all very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all for coming.